This is an exclusive excerpt from the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Nate Henley is the author of The Boy on the Bicycle. It's the true crime story that goes back to 1956 Toronto, the murder of 7-year-old Wayne Millett, and the 14-year-old who was wrongly accused and incarcerated for the crime. Nate joins us on the line right now from Toronto. Hi, Nate.
Hello, Peter. How are you doing?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. Now, I know this is not your first rodeo. You are familiar with the genre of writing true crime stories. So what is it about this particular story that goes back over 60 years that caught your attention?
Well, what really caught my attention was the similarities with the Stephen Truscott case. I had written a book about Stephen Truscott. He was the, 14-year-old boy, small-town Ontario, wrongly convicted of murder in 1959, and then was later acquitted. And I'd written a book about this, and I got an email from this guy, Ron Moffitt, from Sault Ste. Marie, saying, well, I enjoyed your book on Truscott, and I went through the same thing in the 1950s as a 14-year-old. And I thought, okay, that sounds a little weird. So I asked him a few questions, and then I checked newspaper files, because the Toronto Public Library has some great archives of Globe and Mail, Toronto Star from the 1950s, so I could check his story quite easily, and it turned out he was telling the truth, that there had been this awful murder of this little boy, Wayne, at this Canadian National Exhibition, 1956, and Mr. Moffitt was indeed accused of the crime, wrongly convicted. So that was the initial attraction, was just that it was similar to the Truscott case, which I had written about, and it was a case I knew absolutely nothing about, that this was, as a true crime writer, I'm always interested in learning things I don't know anything about, and this was one of those times that I just, it was, complete news to me that this had happened to this, poor teenager in the 50s, and the more I dug into it, the more it sounded like he had really been quite screwed over by the, police, and his was a story that deserved telling. So that was the initial motivation.
Now, again, the book is called The Boy on the Bicycle, and basically
correct.
The situation is that this young boy was killed, and the main suspect was seen supposedly pedaling away?
Correct. The main suspect in the murder encountered a night watchman at the C&E and started chatting away with him, saying all this weird stuff about, do you guys find bodies in the bushes? And, hey, I just saw this kid who looked just like me run away from the C&E. And then this weird kid biked away. So the police believe that this was, the main, culprit in the murder. And as it turned out, the killer was a guy named Peter Woodcock, and he subsequently killed two more children in Toronto, as Ron Moffitt languished, in, custody. And in all three cases, Woodcock, would approach these kids on his bike and impress them with his nifty new racing bike and then offer to give them a ride. And then molest them and kill them. So the term "the boy on the bicycle" actually comes directly from newspaper accounts in the 50s, quoting the police, saying that the boy on the bicycle is the chief, is someone, a person of interest that the police want to speak to concerning, the murders and whatnot. And Mr. Moffitt, who was 14, he was a former CNE employee, and he had the bad timing to run away from home shortly after little Wayne was murdered. His parents reported him missing. Police picked him up, and the next thing they decided he had committed this terrible crime, and they kind of coerced a confession out of him. Ironically, Ron couldn't ride a bicycle, something his mother actually confirmed to the newspapers in the 1950s. He had a poor sense of balance and couldn't ride, so that was a rather significant point. But that is the explanation of the title of the book, The Boy and the Bicycle.
Well, it's that last point that when I read the information on this case and about mm-hmm. your book that I said, well, wait a minute. I can understand sometimes, unfortunately, how mistakes can be made in the course mm-hmm. of an investigation. But how do you gloss over the fact that the kid who you have arrested can't ride a bike?
Yeah, there's a lot. Well, there were a lot of things that were glossed over. The other fact is that several witnesses testified at trial that they had seen Ron Moffitt the night of the murder. They saw Ron Moffitt at the Metro Theater in Toronto and at various times from 5:30 to 9:30. So if he had been in the theater the whole time, obviously he couldn't have, you know, committed the crime. The Crown prosecutor said, well, he was at the theater, but we think he slipped out, stole a bike, even though he couldn't ride, biked to the CNE, where he had previously worked, so he wanted to just hang out at his old stomping grounds, encountered this poor little boy, Wayne. The boy annoyed him. Things got physical, and Ron Moffitt accidentally killed him by smothering him in the dirt. That was the Crown's presentation. And beyond Ron's confession, there was very, very little evidence actually entered in the trial. There was some dental evidence in which they claimed that Ron's teeth matched the bite marks on Wayne's body. Just to jump ahead, when Moffitt was tried for a second time in the spring of 1957, the same the dental expert said, well, no, these bite marks didn't match. So you can sort of toss that evidence out the window. But yeah, there was all sorts of bizarre, glaring things that somehow got overlooked. As a juvenile, Ron was tried just by a judge, not a jury. So that might have explained part of it, because with a jury, you might have had a few people raising reasonable doubts, but with a judge, it's just his decision. And he decided that Ron was guilty, because after all, he confessed without any realization that the confession was coerced and that false confessions happen with alarming regularity even today. There's a study that I cited in my book in which a U.S. law professor examined a database of something like 900 exonerations in the U.S. and found that a very significant number, I believe it was like 16%, I'm just talking off the top of my head, involved a false confession. So these people had confessed to something and then were later, it was found they had nothing to do with it. There's a variety of reasons people give false confessions, but one of the main ones being youth. And Ron was interrogated without a lawyer or a parent present, which is still legal today, by the way. And that is a extremely, you know, puts the young offender at great risk of making a false confession or being so intimidated they kind of agree to anything. But there's a lot, to answer your question, there was a lot of red flags about the whole case, but I think authorities were determined to shut the case as quickly as possible and decided that Ron was their guy, and they put him, you know, put him away, found him guilty.
A lot of true crime books, depending upon their time frame, either the people involved in the story are dead, or are not talking or not capable of talking. But here's a situation with you where mm-hmm. somebody came to you who was yeah. actually the accused perpetrator and then later exonerated. Did that change in any way, the shape or form, the way you conducted yourself in collecting information and writing this book, knowing that you had firsthand knowledge of the person who was wrongly accused?
It did, absolutely. The two main things, it gave me a bit of a huge advantage because I could, you know, obviously quote directly from the person involved. I could ask Ron about his experiences in court. You know, was he scared? Was he depressed? I could ask him about his experiences being interrogated, his experiences later at the Guelph Reformatory. At the same time, I had to be actually doubly careful because as my background is a journalist and I've written other true crime books, I had to corroborate everything he said. So I would look through the records. I found a lot of, like I did a lot of research in old newspaper archives, and it would say February 1, 1957, Ron Moffitt committed to the Bowmanville Boys Training School. And that would confirm that he what he had said during an interview about being committed in February 1957. I was also helped by a fellow crime writer who gave me a package of photocopies of police and various court documents from the 50s because the Toronto police weren't hugely helpful in providing information. So these documents offered the police side of the story. So I had a copy of Moffitt's alleged confession. I had memos from police explaining the investigation. So that allowed me to give them a voice because the problem, and you kind of touch on this, Moffitt being 14 at the time is young enough that he's still alive today. He's 76. Pretty much all the other major players are dead. So I have to find a way to sort of give them a voice so it's not just, you know, the Ron Moffitt story and take his word for it. So I did a lot of archival research and, as I said, finding court and police documents and tried to fill it out, corroborate what Mr. Moffitt had said about his experiences and give voice to police. I had copies of the judicial rulings during his court cases, statements by police about other investigations, that sort of thing. So I was very careful to try to make this that it wasn't just a one-note kind of book, that it wasn't just, here's Ron, here's his experience, and that's it. I'm not going to sort of back it up with any kind of newspaper research or anything like that. I interviewed Ron, dozens of times on the phone, via email, on Skype, and in person. And I could only find a couple small things that where he had his information incorrect because he's remembering from 60 years ago. So he would occasionally, have a date wrong where he appeared in court or something like that. But the central core of his story was absolutely consistent. And I was able to, like I said, to corroborate everything he told me, which was, the main reason I went forward with the book. That if I had been unable to nail down objectively his experience, then I don't know if I would have gone forward with it.
You mentioned earlier that the police were not necessarily forthcoming and helpful in writing this book. Why do you think that is?
Well, part of it involves having to dig through some very old files. I think just there's simply the inconvenience factor that the material. I did a Freedom of Information request with police, and the information I was looking for were like police memos and files from the 1950s. That stuff might be hard to find. And I also discovered that a lot of that material has just been thrown away. That was a bit of a shocker to discover that a lot of these old court files and police files aren't necessarily kept. So a lot of the material I used, as I mentioned, I received a package of information of photocopies of police files in the 50s. That had actually come into the writer's hands because it had been scheduled to be thrown out. So that probably explains a bit of it. And they might not have been too eager to help with a case that doesn't make them look very good either.
You mentioned there were very few people alive involved in this situation, Ron Moffitt being one of the few. Is
yes.
there anybody from Wayne Mallette's family who's still alive?
There is. I reached out to one of the family members. I wrote a letter and explaining who I was, what I was doing, and that I'd be interested in an interview. This is to one of Wayne's brothers, who is still alive. And I said, if you're not interested in the interview, at least I'm going to, this is a heads up that this book is coming out. I received a phone call from the brother's wife, who indicated he did not wish to participate in any kind of interview and was understandably quite upset, but they did appreciate that I'd give them heads up, because they said they had in the past, you know, suddenly they'd be in a situation where someone would say, well, here's a new book that features information about the death of your brother. And so that could be obviously rather shattering. So I didn't push that hard. I respected the family's wishes. I don't want to mention the name. I was hoping to get their insights, and I'm glad I reached out, but understandably, they're still pretty shook up about this 6 decades later.
How long was Ron Moffitt incarcerated?
In total, he was only incarcerated about 8 months, but keep in mind, he was 14. He was labeled a child killer, which typically doesn't sit well with the, you know, prison population. And it pretty much just messed up his life that he served his sentence in various places, like the Bowmanville Boys Training School. He tried to run away from there, was punished quite severely. He was made to stand on a tile floor in the winter with bare feet, that sort of thing. He was transferred to the Guelph Reformatory, which is a prison that housed adults and teenagers. So his experience might not have been, you know, years and years and years, but it was significant enough to really put just, you know, shatter his personality for a long time. And the fact he never really received an official apology, he was acquitted, and the judge basically sort of like criticized him for not telling the truth to police. Sort of like, well, you're innocent, you know, you're not guilty, but, you know, you should have told the truth, young man. And he never received any compensation because his parents couldn't afford a lawsuit. They were broke. So this incident, you know, just destroyed him for quite a long time. And it's to his credit, he pulled his life together.
Well, I was about to ask, I know you're a journalist, not a therapist, but do you, being in contact with him, how would you describe him as a human being, having gone through this? Has he come out the other side? For instance, is he bitter, or what was he like in recapping what has happened to him?
He was always a gentleman. He answered every question I ever asked him, and I asked him some tough stuff, obviously. Usually he would be very matter of fact. Occasionally he would have flashes of anger or bitterness because of his treatment. I was surprised that he was less, that he wasn't as bitter as I was expecting, that if this happened to me, I might be like, he worked for subsequently for most of his adult life as a caretaker in Sault Ste. Marie. He has been married twice. He has 3 children. He has grandchildren. So he really pulled his life together, had a good family life, is enjoying retirement right now. And he has admitted to me that talking to me has been kind of therapeutic, because he held this in for many decades, this whole story. I was astonished that he wasn't more angry and bitter about his experiences. As I said, for the most part, very matter of fact. He's quite, I don't know, I'm trying to think of the right word. He's a bit stoic. He's a bit of an old school kind of guy, an older generation that you don't really throw your emotions all over the place kind of thing. So he can come across as quite reserved, and he's not hugely chatty. Like, he'll give you the information you want, but he's not going to sort of talk at length for hours and hours, you know, bemoaning his fate kind of thing.
But you also described him as somebody who answered every one of your questions. And I was just wondering, do you think part of his personality was, it sounds like he's somebody who was amiable and wanted to please people. Do you think part of his personality is what got him in trouble in the first place when he was a 14-year-old boy?
Yeah, it's actually, research has indicated that police interrogations with juveniles Juveniles tend to be much more trusting and gullible. And when adults tell them things, they tend to be either tend to believe it. So, yeah, I think that did probably hurt him a bit, actually, when he was interrogated, because there's a tendency to these guys are asking you very leading questions, and you're 14, they're an adult, they're cops. There's a tendency to sort of want to agree with them, you know, like you're in school at the time and the teacher says something and you're kind of like, oh yeah, okay, sure, yeah, I did that. So yeah, I think that probably didn't help. He wasn't beaten. I should emphasize that it's not a case that he was like tortured or anything, but he felt threatened by the interrogation, that he felt that the police were hinting that they might get rough with him or something.
Coverage of capital crimes by journalists, also investigational procedures have changed since 1956.
Yes.
Coverage has changed since 1956. Forensics has changed since 1956. But could this happen again?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Even though we have DNA today and we have security cameras, which could have picked up the movements of the killer and the actual crime, police still make mistakes, courts still make mistakes. Look at Toronto Police, the recent investigation into the Barry Sherman and Honey Sherman killings. They were a very wealthy couple who were found dead. This is in the past year or so. And the initial police report was that it was a murder-suicide. And there was a reinvestigation, and then police said, well, actually, we made a mistake. It was a professional hit. It wasn't a murder-suicide. So this is a modern police force with, you know, all the money, all the technology, all the know-how, all the experience, and they still made this huge mistake. And you still have people confessing to stuff that they didn't do for a variety of reasons. Sometimes they're, you know, if they have a drug or alcohol problem, sometimes their memory is a bit muddled. Sometimes they're threatened. Sometimes they're kind of tricked into a confession. So absolutely, it could still happen again. I really hope it doesn't. My one little advocacy point is I'd like to see stricter protocols for police interviews with juveniles, that I think they should have lawyers or adults present when they talk to a young offender.
It's a fascinating story indeed. The book is called The Boy on the Bicycle. Nate, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
I thank you, Peter. I look forward to, you know, hearing more of your programs, and I really enjoyed talking to you.
Nate Henley, author of The Boy on the Bicycle. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0469, and you'll find links to Nate's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You've just heard an exclusive excerpt from the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. To hear any or all of the full hour-long shows, visit thestufffile.com. Stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's thestufffile.com. A presentation of Flying Fish Communications.